Good morning and welcome to The Bridge, Coast Community Radio's own weekly news magazine. I'm Kate Brister. Today we take a break from politics. We'll hear about a special high school soccer program in Woodburn, Oregon, carrying on an impressive tradition. Final playoffs, 30 years in a row. We'll celebrate with this year's team. A new poll shows a majority of Oregonians disagree with the state's removal of endangered species protections for wolves, and most don't see killing as the best solution to conflicts with the animals. We'll hear comments from Aaron Robertson, Communication Coordinator for Oregon Wild. Speaking of wild creatures, correspondent Brian Bull takes us to the Mound Hood Wilderness Area to meet the Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization. About 24 people are gathered to find signs of the elusive Sasquatch. This is The Bridge for the week of October 13th. Eric Bengel of the Daily Historian has our top story in this edition. Eric was at a kickoff panel last week for a new economic development plan for the city of Astoria.
The city of Astoria has begun work on an economic development strategy, and on Wednesday, a panel of business owners and community leaders met at Fort George's Lavelle Showroom to think big about Astoria's economic future. Community Development Director Kevin Cronin said the city plans to incorporate some of the panel members' notes into the development strategy. For example, Sean Bussey, CEO of Kinesis, said Astoria must be careful not to depend on too few industries, particularly those subject to dramatic booms and busts. Jim Knight, Executive Director of the Port of Astoria, said the city needs community partnerships to help create a shared vision that Astorians can get behind. Adam Zimmerman, the President and CEO of Craft 3, said the city must be able to tell a clear and compelling story about itself and where it's going business-wise in a way that will attract outside entrepreneurs. And, Knight pointed out, certain background conditions must be in place for entrepreneurs with families to want to move into a town. Conditions like well-maintained infrastructure, a safe environment, and good schools. Where these and other areas may need improvement, the community should work to improve them. And near the top of Astoria's priorities, in Knight's view, should be the creation of more housing options, because the shortage touches all income levels. Eric Bengel of the Daily Astorian for Coast Community Radio.
Now correspondent Jacob Lewin takes us to Woodburn, Oregon, where one high school soccer team has made it to playoffs 30 years in a row. Most of the players are Latino, as is most of the town. They're celebrating south of the border style.
Woodburn, Oregon's largest majority Latino town, is a place where they celebrate Mexican Independence Day with zest.
Viva Mexico! Viva Mexico!
The high school has a mariachi band. And don't get a Woodburn resident talking about soccer.
Soccer here is, if you've probably heard the expression, is like a religion.
Downtown Business Association President Anthony Veles says soccer is part of the fabric of the community. People of all ages played in the city's parks every evening. And Coach Stan Baker says that's what leads to an extraordinarily successful high school soccer team.
Kids from a young age get a sense of the game from watching it on TV with their family. It's mainly family passing the passion on through generations.
The Woodburn High boys soccer team has made it to the playoffs for 30 straight years. Practices are long.
You guys ready?
Yeah, we are.
Go.
Baker teaches soccer as it's played in Spain, where he was a player.
Get to the corners now. We put a premium on speed of play and passing the ball, moving it quickly, having a more intelligent-based game. The theory is that everything starts in the head, flows through the heart, and ends in the feet, which is the execution.
Every day at practice, we work hard, and we just play for each other, not selfish.
Baker with co-captain Anthony Santien. Officially, the team is called the Bulldogs. Unofficially, Los Perros.
Give it everything, guys. Perros on three.
One, two, three, Perros!
In years past, the team members were all Latinos. Now there are a few Caucasians. Andy Ellingson is a co-captain.
We've all been playing on the same club team since we were like 6 years old. We've been growing up together, playing the same game, playing with the same people.
One thing that's changed in recent years is a decrease in the number of slurs they hear on the road. Co-captain Kevin Vasquez says they haven't completely gone away.
They want to intimidate us, but for the most part, we don't pay no mind. We know we're there for the game, and that's what we focus on.
In recent years, another majority Latino team has become Woodburn's rival. Similar to Woodburn, Hood River Valley is a place where the parents or grandparents of many players came to pick fruit and stayed. Some think that tough work ethic and spirit of sacrifice is showing up in the players. In the last 6 years, either Hood River or Woodburn have won the league championship 5 times. It's September 29th, and the two teams meet.
We absolutely love coming out here to play Woodburn. We know it's going to be a battle every single time.
Coach Jaime Rivera. Hood River is the defending champion, and they had gone undefeated in their last 45 games. One reason is Latino players have a reputation for being willing to take a hit.
I think the passion overshadows the pain.
The bleachers are packed at Woodburn High at kickoff. Only about a minute into the game, the Perros' Reggie Reyes takes a shot on goal. And scores. Soon after, Woodburn adds a second goal. Then Hood River comes back with 3 straight. Finally, with just a couple of minutes left, Woodburn is awarded a penalty kick and scores. The game ends in a 3-3 tie. Woodburn business leader Anthony Velez can't wait to see Hood River in the playoffs, and then maybe a championship for Woodburn.
It's been a real source of pride. Winning a couple state championships always seems to bring people together.
In Woodburn, I'm Jacob Lewin.
This fall, voters will consider higher taxes on companies that do more than $25 million in Oregon sales each year. Proponents say it's the solution to a generations-old problem that will provide needed revenue to schools and other basic public services. Opponents say it's a thinly disguised sales tax that will hurt large and small business. Coast Community Radio and The Oregonian are teaming up to take a deeper look at Measure 97 and what it means for us. To start, how did we get there? Salem correspondent Chris Lehman and the Oregonian's Hillary Borud have the story.
Before we talk about the impact of Measure 97, we need to understand the problem it's intended to solve.
Think about a three-legged stool.
A three-legged stool. I think we're quickly venturing into political cliche territory here, Hillary, but nonetheless, it's probably a useful analogy. So tell us about the three-legged stool.
Well, by this point, most states have 3 main taxes that they get their revenue from: income taxes, property taxes, and a sales tax.
All right, so the three legs are income tax, property tax, and sales tax. Now, Oregon doesn't have a sales tax, so what does that mean?
Oregon's actually one of only 5 states without a sales tax at this point. And what that means is we just have to depend more on property taxes and income taxes. And income taxes tend to go up and down a lot, and that can make it hard to budget.
All right, so if Oregon's missing leg of the stool is a sales tax, why hasn't anyone tried that?
Good question, Chris. It's been on the ballot 9 times since 1933, and it's failed every single time.
Take, for example, 1983.
What alternatives are they representing?
I had to go over to the state archives to find this bit of tape. It's a young lawmaker named Peter Courtney pitching his plan for a sales tax to the skeptical members of the House Revenue Committee.
What are we going to do?
Courtney and her Republican colleague, Tony Van Vliet, wanted to give schools more money by cutting property taxes and creating a 4% sales tax.
It went, today they'd call it, viral? Is that the word you use when you, it went crazy around here.
But not in a good way. The plan went nowhere. It didn't sink Courtney's career, though. He's now the longest serving Senate president in Oregon history.
Chris and I sat down with him in his state capitol office this fall. He told us the 1983 tax plan was crafted to reduce the sting of the sales tax on low-income households.
So I asked him what that meant, and to answer, he just picked up the plan and started reading it out loud.
Food, prescription drugs, utilities, rent, mortgages will not be taxed. That's the line. You know, that was good. Jesus, you know, this was good.
Not good enough for the legislature. Now let's skip ahead almost 20 years.
To September of 2012 and a routine interim floor session in the Oregon Senate. But during the time set aside for announcements, one lawmaker stood up and stunned his colleagues. After nearly a decade in office, Republican Frank Moore said he was calling it quits. Not at the end of his term, but the very next week.
It's been a marathon. But you know, it's been a marathon with no finish line. No finish line. And no finish line in sight.
Keep in mind, this was the heart of the recession. School districts were getting hammered with teacher layoffs and overcrowded classrooms.
Morse had been trying for years to shake up Oregon's tax system, to fix that third leg. In 2007, he and some of his legislative colleagues floated a plan. They called it
Hopeful Reform.
That's Frank Morse this year. Hillary and I invited him back to the Capitol for a look back at Hopeful Reform. He was still more than happy to talk about it.
We would reduce the personal income tax to rates of 2, 4, and 6%, take the capital gains tax down to 4%.
The package had tax breaks of some sort for nearly everyone, but one catch.
Now, offsetting that was a sales tax of 5%.
Ah, the sales tax, the third rail of Oregon politics. Hopeful Reform had no hope of passing.
And given Oregon's history of rejecting the sales tax at the ballot, death by legislature was probably just a shortcut to the proposal's inevitable fate.
So why are Oregonians so dead set against a sales tax? Well, let's face it, no one likes to pay more at the cash register.
But most of the people we spoke with for this story said that the problem isn't that Oregonians are just a bunch of penny pinchers. After all, voters across the state routinely approve local property tax hikes that go towards schools, libraries, and emergency services.
Now, the theory we heard most often is that Oregonians just don't trust their state lawmakers when it comes to spending their hard-earned money. And bear in mind, it was some of those state lawmakers who were telling us this.
Anyhow, Frank Morse's Hopeful Reform plan was dead on arrival, but it still wasn't the end of attempts to overhaul Oregon's tax code.
I want to unveil to you some work that we've been doing over the last couple of weeks.
That's Democratic State Senator Mark Haas in February of this year. He was standing beside a Republican, Representative Mark Johnson, at a state Capitol press conference.
Haas and Johnson rolled out a tax plan that notably did not include a sales tax, but did tax corporations' overall sales, sort of like Measure 97, but at a much lower rate. Still, just like previous efforts, it failed.
It was a three-point shot from the corner, and those don't always go in, and this one clanked.
Haas's attempt at a compromise came just as public employee unions were gathering signatures to get what is now Measure 97 on the Oregon ballot. He knew exactly how heated a campaign over a corporate tax could get.
For a while, Haas held out hope that he might be able to convince lawmakers and Oregon Governor Kate Brown to come back to Salem for a special session.
But it was not to be. It never came up for a vote. Haas said he knew he'd been beat. Sales tax or not, Oregon's tax code once again proved too hot to handle.
I felt defeated. I felt like people were counting on me to find some middle ground there, and I felt like I failed.
And that sense of failure, of regret, that's something we heard repeatedly while putting this story together.
We heard it from Frank Morse.
We tried, but we didn't get there.
And we heard it from Peter Courtney.
I will go to my deathbed feeling that I failed as a legislator because I couldn't make this happen. I thought we were going to really do something great for the state, and I failed.
Oregon voters will decide this fall whether the latest attempt to stabilize Oregon's wobbly tax stool will succeed.
Voters are witnessing one of the fiercest, costliest fights in Oregon political history. And public employee unions and big business are duking it out on the airwaves and in mailboxes for your vote on Measure 97. I'm Hillary Borud.
And I'm Chris Lehman.
Washington wildlife officials say their efforts to cull a pack of wolves in the northeast corner of the state haven't ended the conflict between the predator and cattle that graze in the area. Correspondent Emily Schwing has more.
For the last 2 months, wildlife managers have been shooting wolves in the Profanity Pink Pack from a helicopter. The director of Washington's Department of Fish and Wildlife authorized the killings back in August. Now, a 15th cow has been found dead. The state's wolf policy director, Donnie Martorello, says he doesn't believe the Profanity Pink Pack is going to stop killing cattle.
That is the goal of lethal removal. And based on the pattern that we're seeing in the most recent depredations, we don't believe that we've achieved that goal yet. And so the result is that the lethal removal action by the department is ongoing.
And so is grazing. For 3 more weeks, that's when federal grazing permits on national forest land expire and cows come in for the winter. As for the wolves, only an adult female and three juveniles from that pack remain. The state's tracking the adult with a radio collar. I'm Emily Schwing reporting.
It's unclear if the state will be able to remove all the members of the pack. The terrain where they range is remote and rugged. It's land that is within the borders of the Colville National Forest, which is managed by the U.S. Forest Service. Grazing permits obtained by livestock producers for the Colville National Forest expire at the end of this month. As of June of this year, the department believes there were 19 wolf packs in Washington. 16 of those range in the northeast corner of the state. Authorities in Oregon say wolves killed two calves and wounded a third last week in western Klamath County. The area where the animals were killed is known to be frequented by the rogue pack. Authorities haven't confirmed whether that pack is to blame. Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife reports say wolves killed an 800-pound calf October 2nd, and three wolves were observed feeding on the carcass the next day. A 600-pound calf was killed on the 4th, and a third calf suffered wolf bites the following night. John Stephenson with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service says it's now a higher priority to have a rogue pack member collared to keep track of the animals. He says the pack could be as large as 9 wolves. A majority of Oregonians believe hunting wolves is no way to manage them and that the species still deserves endangered species protection, according to a new poll conducted by Mason-Dixon Polling and Research. More than 70% of Oregon voters who responded said non-lethal prevention methods should be attempted before officials are allowed to kill wolves. Two-thirds said wolves don't pose such an economic threat to the cattle industry that killing them is required. Aaron Robertson of the conservation group Oregon Wild says proposed changes to the Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission's wolf conservation plan could make it easier to kill wolves.
What are the conditions in which the agency essentially deputizes hunters to go out and do wildlife management? And what we found in this poll was that Oregonians disapproved of the kind of management tools that the agency was proposing.
Respondents to the poll spanned the political spectrum, and 30% came from rural Oregon. The poll was conducted at the end of September. At the end of 2015, the commission says there were about 110 wolves in Oregon. According to the poll, 63% disagree with the state's removal of endangered species protection for Oregon wolves. Robertson's group, along with the Center for Biological Diversity and Cascadia Wildlands, are challenging this decision in court, saying the science behind the decision is flawed.
There were a number of scientists that commented that the science wasn't rigorous enough and they had a number of concerns, and those concerns were never addressed because there was no revision. So the decision, which was based on a report that was never peer-reviewed, was in violation of Oregon law.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission held a meeting last week in LeGrand on proposed changes to the state's wolf management plan and will hold another meeting on December 2nd in Salem. You're listening to The Bridge.
So many people have seen him, there's a real long list. Of course I believe that he exists. He's got real big feet and a real strong fist. Bigfoot!
Yes, we're talking Bigfoot. The towering creature of legend is nearly impossible to spot, but that hasn't hurt his popularity. While early exposure included plaster foot casts and grainy film footage, Bigfoot today is on TV, countless books and websites, and even has an action figure. Brian Bull measures the creature's cultural footprint.
So I'm pretty high up here in the Mount Hood Wilderness area, navigating some pretty crude roads. You gotta watch out for big rocks and potholes and logs. But I'm getting close to the site of a group of people with the BFRO, Bigfoot Field Researchers Organization, where roughly 24 people are assembled to try to find signs of the elusive Sasquatch.
It's a glorified camping trip, or camping with a purpose, you could say.
The BFRO was founded in 1995. Cindy Rose Cadell organized its latest Oregon expedition. With some heaving and shoving, she shows off one of their high-tech tools for tracking Bigfoot.
They call the thermal eye. It picks up all the heat signatures in the woods. So if you see nothing else, it's kind of fun to see elk and deer and even mice. We have a monitor in the truck, and we view it from the back seat. It's actually used from the Army, and they used to put them on the bottom of planes.
Such hardware sells for about $10,000. Hardcore Bigfoot hunter Joe Bielart says he's made major investments in his quest.
Certainly over $20,000, probably in the neighborhood of $30,000 when you include some specialized camera equipment. If you get good photographs of Bigfoot and control them, you will easily make $1 million.
Bielart's still working on that. But Bigfoot's already a moneymaker through movies, including 1987's Harry and the Hendersons.
Sit!
And the creature just appeared in an original play, The Bigfoot Letters, which opened in Cleveland last month.
Damn, that's impressive! What does that mean?
It's a distress call, particularly between a mated couple.
And it's the elusive reality TV star of Animal Planet's Finding Bigfoot.
And that's when I hear big footsteps coming just inside the tree line to my right.
What the title of that show really ought to be is Not Finding Bigfoot.
Robert Thompson is a pop culture professor at Syracuse University. Bigfoot's following intrigues him, given the lack of definitive proof every show.
This would have been the equivalent if back in the early 1980s, they would have never told us who shot JR. They'd have put us through that incredible cliffhanger, and then the show would have gone season after season after season, and they would never find out the answer.
This hasn't hurt Finding Bigfoot. It's been renewed for a 9th season. Surely something to howl about. Cliff Berrickman of Portland is a self-described Bigfoot nerd and co-star of Finding Bigfoot. He gathers odd forest sounds from across the continent, which he says could be the creature.
The most compelling evidence for Sasquatches, in my opinion, the congruency of all the available evidence. The whistling, the howling, that sort of thing. When I look at historical newspaper accounts dating back to the 1800s or even earlier, they're reporting the same behaviors. They're reporting the same physical descriptions and locations as we find today.
But Joe Nickel of the Center for Skeptical Inquiry says existing evidence is shoddy, fraudulent, or just not there.
All of the paranormal, flying saucers, ghosts, psychics, all of it, is based on a logical fallacy called an argument from ignorance. We don't know, therefore we do know. We don't know what left these tracks. We don't know what that bright light in the sky was. We don't know what made the noise in the old house. Therefore, we have Bigfoot, an extraterrestrial craft, and a ghost.
Nickel says the majority of supposed Bigfoot sightings are actually
the Bigfoot bear. And by that I mean any bear.
The debate will go on, as will Bigfoot's cultural status. One pitch at a time if you're a baseball fan in Oregon's second largest city.
We are at the Eugene Emerald Sasquatch Awareness Night.
Gunnar Monson is a Bigfootologist who owns the Sasquatch Coffee Company in Garibaldi. He mans a table covered with plaster foot casts, Bigfoot toys, and coffee pouches. It complements the Emerald's Bigfoot statue near the restrooms and the creature's likeness on jerseys, pennants, and baseball diamond. Monson says believers and skeptics alike should keep an open mind and make the most of any expedition.
More often than not, when you go out looking, something doesn't happen. So you go Bigfooting with friends and enjoy their company.
Meanwhile, Bigfoot nerd Cliff Berrickman says shows like Finding Bigfoot, as well as the internet and social media, have finally given believers a supportive community. He thinks this is essential for when the fateful day comes when a Bigfoot is either hunted down or accidentally killed.
And when that day happens, that's the first day they need protection. They need protection from us. So I want people to love Bigfoots for whatever they think they are right now. I want an army of Bigfoot lovers ready to mobilize to protect them and their habitat.
So Bigfoot, if you're listening, there are legions of fans who've got your elusive hairy back. I'm Brian Bull, reporting in Eugene.
We're living in a Bigfoot.
That's all we have time for on this edition of The Bridge. If you missed any part of it or just want to hear it again, it's available as a podcast on our website at coastradio.org. We enjoy hearing from you. Send your questions and comments to News One. That's NEWS and the numeral 1 at KMUN.org. I'm Kate Brister. Thank you for listening. Join us next time on The Bridge. The Bridge is a production of Coast Community Radio.